Sam Cedar, where every day's Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday, Tuesday, Casual Tuesday, Wednesday, Casual Hump Day, Thursday, Casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 30, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex Perrine, staff writer from the New Republic, and co-host of The Politics of Everything. On the program today, also later on the program, Matthew Film Guy will be joining us with a movie recommendation, a film recommendation for the weekend. Meanwhile, the Delta variant begins to spur vaccine sort of mandates. CDC seeing new data showing that the Delta variant is as contagious as chickenpox and may be more virulent than the wild type COVID. Meanwhile, star of the day, Kristen Sinema, tells Chuck Schumer, "I won't be here to vote if it impacts my vacation." Joe Biden announces support for immigration reform in the reconciliation bill. Will it make a difference? Meanwhile, the first evacuation air flight of 200 Afghans lands in the U.S. The highest-ranking U.S. official in the Catholic Church is now facing sex abuse charges. Ethiopian government cuts off a loan supply route to Tigray, potentially causing a massive famine. And the U.S. faces a naloxone shortage. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Casual Friday. I know there is some chatter out there as to why I'm wearing sleeves on my shirt. We are still working on the details of the Sun's Out, Guns Out promise. But nevertheless, we will get there. Sun is still out. Isn't that right, Emma Vigeland? Welcome to the show.
I guess it is out. I guess the sun is still out.
The sun is still out.
I don't know, man. It's Friday. Got a little bit of a cold.
All right. Wow. All right. I can see you a little bit.
Do you hear me? I'm a little stuffy, right? It's not COVID. I got tested, even though I'm fully vaxxed. You know, it's just you worry about these breakthrough infections now.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot anecdotally. In terms of like data, we have yet to sort of see. Any numbers of people who have been vaccinated, any significant numbers of people who have been vaccinated being hospitalized. Yet, this data is coming in and the best thing to do is to be at times somewhat, overly cautious. And that may or may not wearing a mask indoors may be overly cautious. It may not. It's appearing that it certainly makes a difference. Certainly when we spoke to Michael Olmsted, the protection one gets from a mask, particularly if everyone is masked in a room, it's a function of the quality of the masks in terms of time that it protects you for. But nevertheless, it does provide some protection. And we are seeing some places in Florida now get beyond their peaks from last summer, and I by places I mean hospitals. We're seeing record spikes in Japan, obviously not in this country, but there's also we're seeing around the country, you know, some real problems with spikes, and we're going to get more data in. This is the way this thing works, is that we just simply, again, we don't always know in real time.
The novel virus, folks, novel virus.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know why that's so difficult for some people to wrap their heads around. Like, I understand that maybe it is some people, it is a function of willful ignorance. But for instance, let's play this clip of Joe Biden getting this question from Alcindor, from Yumichi Alcindor. She's a PBS correspondent. And she asked the question, which is a fairly fair question. Why not push for vaccine mandates in states, private companies, schools? Here's that exchange with Joe Biden.
Not push for vaccine mandates in states, private companies, schools. Do you want to see those entities pass vaccine mandates?
Well, I'd like to see them continue to move in that direction. And that's why I pointed out. I had asked the Justice Department to determine whether that is they're able to do that legally, and they can. Local communities can do that. Local businesses can do that. It's still a question whether the federal government can mandate the whole country. I don't know that yet.
We may need to actually, you know, end up there in something
right.
The reason why we see an absence of vaccination mandates is because we have a political party that is dedicated to the proposition that we're going to exploit this in any way we can and make it worse for people. I mean, I don't know how else to express that. I mean,
And a media apparatus that completely buttresses that effort.
Without a doubt. And you know, and then there's just sort of like, we hear this refrain over and over again from every right-wing media outlet that it seems to be out there. And to like sort of contrarian, full-on right-wingers. And here it is, Representative Chip Roy, in the U.S. Capitol, whining because, of course, Nancy Pelosi has now said, you know, we're going to have to reinstall the mask mandate. Here's Chip Roy from Texas.
Here on the People's House, we got to go around and see, okay, we can't come to the floor. I can't execute my constitutional duty unless I wear a mask. Well, which is it, vaccines or masks? Do the vaccines work or they don't work? Do the masks work or they don't work? I'd like to know which it is. I'd like Dr. Fauci to come down and answer a single question about natural immunity. Have you been infected with a virus? Do you have immunity? Or are they just going to go around poking people saying you must take a vaccine? Oh, but sorry, the vaccine doesn't work. You must wear a mask. This institution is a sham, and we should adjourn and shut this place down.
Oh, I love Marjorie Taylor Greene in the background. Giving
standing
her
ovation.
Standing, I mean, ovation. That's all she's good for now that she's not on any committees. So
this would be laughable. This would be laughable if it wasn't for the deaths that we're seeing. I mean, it's every day you can open the newspaper, see somebody, see a story of somebody in a hospital in Missouri or Arkansas or Texas begging their doctors for a vaccine as they are dying. And it's too late then. But the idea, and I don't know if they're just lying or they're this stupid. The idea that they cannot wrap their heads around about the idea of context, the idea of reducing probability or possibility of getting COVID.
You've already lost them.
Every mask, like, you know, there's no difference between a cotton, you know, like a t-shirt, like a bandana, and an N95 mask. Like, do they, like, let's start with that concept. Do you understand that some things provide some protection, other things provide more protection, nothing provides total protection? There's no, I don't know if there's a vaccine out there. Well, I guess there are some vaccines that that you don't see any breakthrough infections. But we have a flu vaccine that gets released every year that has a 40% to 60% efficacy, and people seem to understand that concept. That, like, okay, we don't have a vaccine that has 100% efficacy. We have a new variant. And do people expect that the variant's not going to make a difference on the vaccine? Do people not understand the concept of, like, you can do multiple things? I mean, it's just absurd. Why would you lock your door to your house if you have a burglar alarm? Is it a burglar alarm or is it a lock? Which one is it?
Well,
is it a burglar alarm or is it a lock?
And would you use both, say, if there were a rise in burglaries in your neighborhood and you were particularly susceptible to burglaries and your window was open? I mean, maybe you would use both pieces of protection.
Do you shut your window? You lock your windows and you shut them? Or do you shut them or do you lock them? Mm. And then why do you have a burglar alarm? Like, I mean, it's just... I have an 8-year-old child who understands this concept better than these people do, and they're willfully ignorant. And you could find this. I mean, I imagine there's some people in certain quarters just do it because they know that it, you know, they're appealing to anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers. But I just don't understand how someone who is actually capable of tying their shoes can't understand this concept and can't understand the concept of a pandemic. And yes, you know, I think there is a lot of validity to saying that younger people, largely the younger you get, there's you certainly have less of a risk of dying or getting serious complications from COVID. But we also know this thing is bouncing around and it is mutating, and there's no guarantee that the next round of mutation won't be that much more lethal. And we want to wipe it out to the extent that we can.
And we didn't even point out the fact that, is Chip Roy vaccinated? Is Marjorie Taylor, like, they're basically advocating for no vaccinations and no masks. So it's a false choice that they're not even making.
Right.
Like, why are they so up in arms about a conversation that they've decided they're on the sidelines for?
Does he bum out about the fact he's got to wear a shirt in the house? Like, when he comes up and he speaks in the people's house, he's doing his constitutionally mandated duty of speaking. Is he bummed out that he's got to wear a shirt?
No shirt, no shoes, no service. That's essentially slavery, Sam.
Yeah, I mean, we already banned drunk driving. Why do I have to wear my seatbelt?
Exactly. Exactly. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Perrin, talking about what we've seen this week in our politics. We'll be right back after this. Folks, we got two sponsors of today's program. The first, of course, is Sunset Lake. Oh, I should tell you that sometimes we get binged on YouTube if we use certain letters in a certain combination. If we use the letter C and then we use a different letter, let's say B, and then we use even a third letter, let's say D, and we use those together, we sometimes have some problems with YouTube. So I say Sebede instead of actually using those.
Well, it's sexier, right? You know, it's also
just my hook now. So one of our my favorite sponsors is a Sunset Lake Sebede. They are a farm up in outside of Burlington, Vermont. Started out doing dairy for Ben and Jerry's. Kudos to Ben and Jerry's for their most recent decision about selling their ice cream in the West Bank and occupied territories. And they decided to diversify. They started growing hemp, and they use integrated pest management, no pesticides, 100% organic, fertilizer. They work with the University of Vermont to develop regenerative farming practices. They also have great business practices, $15 minimum wage, mostly employee owned, and they're movement partners. They've been supporting local initiatives around Burlington. They've donated money and drawn attention to the strike in Worcester, the St. Vincent's nurses. And we should also say that strike is going into, like, I think it's like a fourth month now. And Tenet, the big hospital conglomerate, they're having to contract their services at St. Vincent's, and the nurses are hanging tough. You can head over there and support it. But Sunset Lake Sebade also, in addition to doing all these other things, they have a great product. They have tinctures. They have a tincture now with melatonin, which I use to help me sleep. It has been a fantastic boon to my ability to get off of Ambien, frankly. And they also have Sebade fudge and coffee. They have gummies that are fantastic. They have smokables. It really is an amazing array of products, and all of the contents fully documented. These products have real integrity. You know what you're getting. They have different milligram doses of the tinctures. I can't speak highly enough about their business practices, their movement practices, and frankly, their product. The Solve with Arnica has been a godsend to me. My eczema has, like I say, this is just for me. They make no claims about it at all. I don't even think they even contemplated somebody would use it that way. They also have a hand lotion. Check it out, folks. And you get 20% off with the coupon code Left Is Best. Fans of the show, they wanted Left Is Best, one word, Sunset Lake Sebade. You can, of course, find the link in our YouTube and podcast descriptions. Also, I've told this story many times before. Dinner time can be hectic and chaotic. And the beauty of Freshly is their chefs take care of your meals a few nights a week. They take the pressure off of you. In my instance, I got introduced to Freshly way before they became sponsors of this program. My mom, we were worried that she wasn't eating properly. She's going through some health issues, and we wanted to send her meals that she wouldn't have to really do anything to prepare, just heat them up. And but we were also afraid that she wouldn't accept them from us if she thought we were paying for them. So we told a white lie, a little tiny fib, that they were sponsoring the show and they would give me a lifetime of free Freshly. And I said, no, send it to my mom. And so my mom has been getting it for a couple of years now. And was like almost every time I get on the phone with her, she would bring it up as if it was really the only thing I'd ever done for her in her entire life. But she would speak glowingly, her favorite steak peppercorn. And then Freshly just coincidentally became sponsors of the show. And then I told the story, and then my mom found out I'd been lying to her for a couple of years. So, but nevertheless, Freshly makes chef-made, nutrient-packed, delicious meals delivered fresh to your door or your mom's door. No cooking is required. They arrive cooked and fresh every week. You can keep them in your fridge. You skip the trip to the store. You don't have to worry about cooking. Ordering is easy. You go to Freshly.com. You choose from over 30 meals. Like my mom's favorite, steak peppercorn, sausage baked penne, their chicken pesto bowl. Freshly can fit your lifestyle. They've got a variety of plans. They got meals to pick from that work for your needs. And now our listeners can try Freshly for just $6.16 per meal. Kids, are you hungry? Wait, Wait, you got to wait 5 minutes, and I got something delicious for you. Those words have come out of my mouth actually many, many times. Right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to freshly.com/majority. You can stop stressing about dinner. Go to freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. That's freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. Okay, I want to welcome to the program, back to the program, one of our regular Casual Friday guests. He is a staff writer with the New Republic and the co-host of the Politics of Everything, Alex Perrine. Hello, Alex. I'm here with Emma.
Hi, Emma. Hi, Sam.
I guess I don't need to say that. I mean, you can see that.
I can see that you are there. Yeah.
I guess I'm just sort of used to, you know, it's sort of my radio background where I just assume that there can't be anybody seeing. But and you, of course, know Emma.
Right,
Alex. So here we are. It is the end of July.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of knew it was coming down to this, and we are. Well, there's a couple of things that I don't want to put it all on the table right now, and then we can sort of work our way through it. But there's a really sort of fascinating dynamic that is starting, and there's two major stories. Obviously, they're happening. One is the infrastructure bill or bills. And the other is we've got this January 6th commission. There was some pretty compelling testimony earlier this week. This is going to go through August, at least parts of it. And we're going to the House Democrats seem far more interested in compelling testimony this time around than they did during the impeachment hearings. They're skipping the whole voluntarily show up type of thing and going directly to the compulsion. And we'll see. We have a different DOJ now and whether the DOJ will back that up. And then we also have Donald Trump endorsing a candidate in Texas. There was a special election in Texas, two Republicans in a runoff. He endorsed one at the behest of the Club for Growth. Mm-hmm. And the sort of like, I guess, the Texas establishment endorsed the other. Mm-hmm. And Trump lost, which is, we should also say, not necessarily, you know, there was plenty of times where he endorsed people, it seemed, and they lost.
Yeah.
In the past.
His record wasn't like sterling on that.
It wasn't sterling. But the interesting thing, the dynamic here with the Republicans, and I do think all of these three sort of like silos are a part of a whole. With Trump, I think he's much more dangerous when he's just against you versus supporting somebody.
Yep.
But the Republicans can't escape him.
Right.
and they sort of, I think, want to, but they can't. I'm talking maybe the leadership. I mean, I think, you know, increasingly they're just becoming mini Trumps. But this January 6th thing, we're sort of seeing that there, right? Like this is playing out. Trump wants them to sort of be more like lean into this thing. They want to lean away from it.
Yeah.
Kevin McCarthy pulled people off of his response to the select committee, not including Jim Jordan and Jim Banks, was to pull Republicans off the economic equality select committee. That must have been really tough for the Republicans. I mean, give me your sense, at least in that first two sort of silos of thing, like, you know, what the dynamic is there.
I think as you point out, right, like Trump's history of endorsing Republicans has not always led to those Republicans winning, which I think goes to the fact that the appeal is him. Right. Like he can endorse guys. And who was it? He got pissed off at because they told him to endorse him and then he lost anyway. I forget who that was. It was like a Senate. One of the Senate races. And
it was
midterm.
Was it the one to replace Jeff Sessions?
I think. Yeah. It was to,
Roy
yeah,
Moore.
To,
when
yeah, right,
Roy
yeah.
Moore.
Roy Moore. Yeah.
Roy Moore. Yeah. Yeah. So and I think the interesting thing is like, you know, so Trump can endorse a Republican, but that doesn't actually like it doesn't make his magic kind of like go on to that guy because if you know the voters want the genuine article, right? And so I don't know. I think that like what we're going to see going forward is like all of these mini Trump attempts. I don't know. It's unclear how far they'll go because the appeal is really tied up in the guy himself.
And part of that too is like, I mean, don't want to cut you off, but part of that too is that his energy into going against somebody and fighting somebody who he's against, he can't match that when it's not him on the ballot, if that makes sense. He's such a narcissist that he's not going to put his energy into advocating for somebody in the same way that he would for himself, or if, you know, he's fighting another person who he feels personally wronged by.
Right. He can only go positive in a way that it reflects well on him, right?
Yes.
Like his intensely negative energy is like 99% of his charisma and magnetism. And like when he's just like, you know, he can barely rouse himself up to say anything nice about other people. And, you know, obviously Republicans can tell that. But then the commission thing is interesting because I think that's what he wants to be happening with that. Not pull the Republicans off, but like just completely make it a circus, defend what happened. Like, don't like hope this goes away, but go on the attack on this.
And what's interesting is this, is that like, the reason why more often than not you have parties who are out of power win in the off year elections is because they're running against the sitting president, right?
Yeah.
In some ways, what Donald Trump is setting up for the Democrats, and I don't think that they've had a sort of some type of epiphany as much as it's so obvious. The Democrats are running against Donald Trump again in 2022. Usually you don't have a Republican president, you know, to run against when you have a Democratic president.
Yeah.
But on some level, the Democrats do. I mean, people have to remember this. Like when I was doing radio in 2004 and 5 at Air America, we would still get conservative callers who would call in and talk about Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Like 5 or 6 years later, I mean, the Republicans knew how to create a boogeyman that was way off the scene, right? I mean, you're talking 5 or 6 years out, you know, even in his second term, George Bush is still blaming Bill Clinton for things, whereas Barack Obama on day one was like, we got to turn the page.
Yeah.
They never, never. And of course, that's why you get such an easy reformation of George W. Bush, who was incredibly unpopular by the time he left. The easy reformation because Obama basically just said, you know, took the hook out of his mouth and they didn't do this. And the Democrats this time around, I don't know that they've had an epiphany and understand how to do politics again, but it's so obvious. And, you know, I think people can argue as to how, you know, the magnitude of January 6th, right? I mean, I think there's, you know, some folks I see undersell this significantly. Certainly we see some people, I think, overplay it a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, the notion of politicians using hyperbole is one thing or another. It's definitely something that one feels like should be investigated, right? I mean, the idea that you had thousands of people storming the Capitol, you know, trying to prevent the president from being certified, it might have had inside help. It feels
might
like
want to look
it
into
should
that.
Be investigated. But the Democrats understand, I think, from a political standpoint, strictly as a political standpoint, the Democrats seem to understand that the more they empower Donald Trump from afar, the better they're going to do in 2024 because he's not on the ballot.
Right, exactly.
He will motivate people to come out and vote against him.
It's a completely different when he's on the ballot versus when he isn't.
Yes. And like so he by not being there, but being there.
Yeah. He's present in the minds of the voters who are motivated to vote in the midterm, but then the people who are only motivated to vote for Donald Trump, they didn't show up in the last one, you know?
Well,
when
not,
he wasn't
not,
on the ballot.
I mean, they did, but not in the same numbers.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, like Republicans in 2018, you had Republicans and Democrats both get record voters, but the Democrats just had more. And, you know, we had, I think it was 7, 8, 10 million voters who were new to the process because they were coming in and voting against Donald Trump. And so and I think the Republicans realized this. And I think that's what was going on with their sort of like spin pirouettes on the vaccines over the past couple of weeks. And it may dovetail into the bipartisan sort of attempt on this infrastructure bill.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know. It looks like that thing. It's shocking to think of 10 Republican senators voting to advance anything for a Democratic president. So I don't know. It's like if and when that happens, it says it's going to say something about like what they would rather be talking about going into the next midterm.
I think there were 17 Republican senators who voted to cloture on that first sort of process vote.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, this is I mean, I think clearly the Republicans seem to be a little bit nervous of this whole sort of Donald Trump effect. Because they have, I think they must be looking at polling, right? I mean, like, what did you make of their whole turnaround on vaccines?
I don't know. That was an interesting one. Cause it seemed it seemed coordinated, came from Fox pretty directly, but then like sort of filtered to everyone else. So it's like, maybe Rupert said, you got to cut this out. Maybe it was the markets, you know, maybe someone was like, all right, like if we can't get these numbers up, like the market recovery is going to get screwed. But I don't know. I think it was also like, it was could have been any number of factors, but it was definitely a sort of a weird sudden thing.
Well, that was Emma's argument about the market, but you know, remember Steve Scalise also. I guess it was a week ago. Was it this past Sunday or 2 weeks ago Sunday? You know, finally got his vaccination, or at least admitted publicly that he had gotten a vaccination. You know, I am, who knows as to when he actually got vaccinated, but I think it was beyond Fox, and I think it must be that they're looking at polling that shows that their anti-vax stance and their sort of COVID denial is hurting them. And to me, that feels like a proxy for it is putting too much of a Trump patina on them.
Yeah.
And without Trump to draw their voters in, but with enough Trump to draw the opposing voters out.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm not convinced that wasn't what happened in Texas, frankly.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that's definitely something that we've seen it before. where you have a group of voters whose only motivation is to vote for Donald Trump, who actually don't like Republicans. I mean, that was why he won the presidential election to begin with. He won people who did not actually like Republicans or Republican politicians. He won the Republican nomination by attacking Republican politicians. And what they haven't been able to crack is how to get those people to come vote for Republicans that aren't Donald Trump. But yeah, I think I think you could be right about the sort of encouraging the spread of COVID not polling well, but also like
isn't it that sort of?
But I mean, they also might have just looked at like, you know, as a culture war issue, it made a certain amount of sense for talk radio and cable news ratings. It doesn't make a lot of sense electorally to encourage your base not to get vaccinated against a disease, you know, like.
And
like
that's why Mitch McConnell's panicking a little bit. I mean, that's why Republican leadership is panicking a little bit. I mean, I know you mentioned my market theory, but I think, Sam, you sold me on it before, like about how this is more just they are worried about the suburban voter, which they lost handily to Biden in the last election.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there was this assumption, right, that existed out there that the Republicans would, well, you know, Joe Biden had it. Once Donald Trump is gone, the Republicans are going to come to their senses. And they seem like they're trying to do both.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Yeah. And this has been, I think you can sort of observe the split pretty clearly in the difference between House Democrats and Senate, or House Republicans and Senate Republicans, right? Like, that's where the split is. Like, the Senate is, you know, trying to play the everything's gone back to normal, please forget the last few years, just like you forgot Bush game. And in the House, they're still going like full throttle, like 100% Trumpism. For the most part, that's still what is like leading in the House.
Right now, as we speak, Steve Dennis, who is a Bloomberg Senate reporter, said there was a slight delay in a procedural vote on the bipartisan, the Portman Cinema infrastructure bill. There was a delay. They are now voting. And so we'll see what happens with this round. But let's dig into this. At one point, Mitch McConnell must have realized if we sink the bipartisan bill, we are losing our best chance at splitting the Democrats for their reconciliation, right? I mean, that must have been what happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a pretty clear strategy to water down the bill and then to try to convince Democrats to revolt against passing the reconciliation bill or the full amount of what they want in the reconciliation bill.
The amount of praise that Mitch McConnell is heaping on Kristen Sinema and to some extent Joe Manchin, but really it's Kristen Sinema, is huge. And it was also, I guess, like, I mean, Sinema, you know, is she's feeling it right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, she's feeling it. She has marshaled this, supposed bipartisan bill. She has done what, you know, we've all said is like, is this really going to happen? Are they going to get 10 Republican votes for this? And it's starting to appear like they will. Mm-hmm. And now she's out there saying, $3.5 trillion. I'm not on board with that. I'm on board with the sort of broad strokes of a reconciliation bill, but not that number. She's telling Chuck Schumer, you better get your voting done soon. Cause I can't miss
my vacation. Yeah.
I don't know where she's going, a Burning Man or whatever it is. I don't know. But,
she's going to do some improv.
I have no idea, but she is feeling it now, and one wonders if there's any, you know, what it's going to take to, how on top of this is she from a political standpoint? Because I think she's making a lot of people angry.
Yeah.
And this is going to I haven't heard you don't hear this about, like, you know, West Virginia, you're not hearing like every quarter saying we need to primary Joe Manchin. But Kristen Sinema is not in a red state. She's in a purple state.
Yep. Yeah.
Vast majority of people who voted for her voted for Joe Biden.
Yep.
There are a lot of apparently good candidates to primary her. I've heard stuff out of Arizona, like nobody thought she could actually win in the primary and nobody took her seriously when it came to the Senate race. And then she won.
Yeah.
And so people had to line up behind her. But I get the feeling that there's a lot of donors who are going to abandon her if she sinks this bill.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, I think that she's, and we can all debate about her, you know, sincerity or whatever, but she's operating from a sort of mid 2000s Senate moderate playbook where the goal here was to get the photo op flanked by Republican senators. Like, look, I'm out here right in front getting a bipartisan deal done, and win praise for deal making. But, yeah, I mean, you know, her, the way elections work now is you turn out the people on your side, and she's been alienating them in Arizona. It's not a situation where there's no realistic path to her getting a ton of Republicans to vote for her, I don't think, once that she's running against an actual living Republican in Arizona. The people who are like, oh, I like her bipartisan moderateness are going to, but I also want Republicans to be in charge. Like, they're going to pick the Republican. Right. And I don't know. I wonder, she's years away from facing voters too. So I don't know. Like, it's hard to say what she wants out of this besides winning that praise and being the fulcrum of negotiations.
I mean, look at this. I mean, Bradley, if you could pull this up, look at this photo op from her. I mean, I this is a bit of an aesthetic point, but she's like, that's Portman, right? This is just so weird. This is a weird brand of, I mean, again, this is why I say big theater kid energy.
What is he saying at that point? Everybody else seems to be laughing.
It looks suggestive.
It's almost as if he just said, like, incidentally, I'm going to, I stole Kristen's retirement fund, and everybody laughs, and she's like, wait, what?
Wait, please, sir, I want some more. I mean, it's just a weird, like, I read this great profile on her I read this great profile on her in Mother Jones, and her background as a Green Party activist, and kind of like how it seems like the only driving principle that she has is being an iconoclast.
Yeah.
And there are quotes from her in the newspaper in 2003 about what's Joe Lieberman even running on? Why does he run as a Democrat who wants to appeal to Republicans? And it's like, lady, this is her whole brand now. I'm not sure exactly what she's doing, because I think you guys are right. This is not ringing true. That weird pose, that kind of theatrical, performative stuff, it's not going to resonate, because it's certainly repulsive to me. I can't imagine it's resonating with people.
Well, also, look, she's also got, and she developed it very quickly, but she's got advanced Senate brain, right? And Senate brain means the goal of what you were doing in the Senate is to get that photo and then to pass a bipartisan bill. And if that means you delay something for months and months as it gets less and less popular and people argue more and more over the details of it, and people start to hate whatever this thing you're arguing about more and more, that's the object, is like prolonged negotiations. And then at the end of it, this is just about like the least popular thing a politician can do, is when Chuck Schumer is like, well, we're going to have to work hard this summer. You say, no, I'm not missing my vacation.
Yeah.
That's just not a popular thing to say public or to have reported about you.
And to be clear, like, she does not have the option. I mean, I guess she could switch to the Republican Party now, but that would be the end of her career. She does not have the Joe Lieberman option of running as a, you know, Connecticut for Joe Lieberman candidate, because Joe Lieberman had an extended, I mean, Lieberman
was in politics for a long time.
I went to college in Connecticut in the 1980s, and Joe Lieberman was on the TV as the attorney general taking credit for the toll booths being removed in Connecticut. I mean, this guy had a very long history in Connecticut politics. She does not have that kind of base. She doesn't have many options. And I can understand, like, what she thought she was doing for her brand to do the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And we should be clear on that. That bill is not a bad bill. It's woefully insufficient.
Right.
But if you combine it with the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, all good.
Yeah.
The privatizing elements of that, which we had talked about on this program, there was a public-private partnerships, went from like billions of dollars down to like $100 million or something like that. You know, just completely nominal and largely irrelevant. The pay fors are also sort of like weird, you know, Senate fiction stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
where they're just gimmicks, like, and like, yeah,
exactly. It's all just sort of like accounting stuff and shifting money around. It's nothing terribly problematic at all. I mean, it's just like an insufficient, mediocre, not game changing, but certainly like, yeah, we'll take some funding for Amtrak. Yeah, we'll take some broadband. Yes, it will shore up some roads and this and that. Not a bad, you know, bill. And I think to the Democrats' benefit to have passed an, you know, a bipartisan thing, because the Republicans still have this liability of Donald Trump out there, and people can still vote against Donald Trump, even though they're doing the bipartisan thing. But they, the Democrats can brag like, we passed the first bipartisan legislation that has been passed in, you know, whatever it is, 10 years or something. Yeah. And it wouldn't, you know, broadly speaking, not true, but, you know, the biggest bipartisan piece of legislation in 10 years. And what I don't understand is, unless it's going to be like, she's just like, what the rationale is for her other than to get more attention and be star of the day to come out against the reconciliation bill, or at least, you know, maybe one thing, if she comes in, she's like, I want it to be $3.4 trillion.
Well, right. So then this is the question. So there's two scenarios here. And one is, again, going to the idea of just pure Senate brain, the idea that you got to take the number and you got to bring the number to an arbitrary amount down. Like that's classic Senate negotiation. Here's a number. I arbitrarily want it to be a little bit smaller, you know, and then I'm fine with it. But then the other thing is holding out the possibility that she can scotch the bill in order to remove some potential part of it that she won't admit is actually the thing she's against, right? Like if they try to include something that she doesn't want to openly say she opposes, like this is the threat she can use to try to get it out of there.
All right, just to be more clear on that, that's like Joe Manchin. He doesn't want like the corporate disclosure stuff for the People Act.
Exactly.
But so he comes out and he supports the John Lewis Plus bill.
Yeah.
And so it's really not, he gets to, he's basically carving something out of the bill that he doesn't like, and presumably is his donors don't like. And maybe that's a redundant thing there, without having to take the sort of political hit of taking out something that like most people would be like, hey, wait a second.
That sounds fine. Like that disclosing. Sounds,
yeah. Better than fine. I mean, and one wonders if it is the latter, if your theory is correct, that she could be going for something to carve out of the bill. One wonders like, you know, who she's doing that on whose behalf.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly, you know, donors, but it also could be like, there could be people like Mark Warner and these people who don't feel like I can afford to get up there because I'm in a bluer state and say like, hey, I don't want this or that. And she could be doing that work as a way.
Well, right. Like, and, you know, Warner in particular, like it's incredible what he gets away with. But like he doesn't want any part of the PRO Act in there. And that's still, I think, on the table to put some of that in there. Warner doesn't want, like he's come out against, or he's been, he said he doesn't support the PRO Act, but like he can't, like he doesn't want to come out and take the hit on that, I don't think. And Sinema can, who will go thumbs down the minimum wage and like just take that hit, is like out there able to do whatever, you know, someone like him might want.
But Warner wants to operate in the shadows. That's his.
He doesn't want the Democratic electorate to know how conservative he is.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with the filibuster fight. Right. Like that's also the function that Manchin and Sinema serve for him on that front. They're his cover.
Yeah.
And others too.
And it's possible there is a scenario where Schumer, you know, moves this thing quite along and they get to like even the Votorama before they go on vacation. I can't even believe like it's just so stunning to me that we're talking about this stuff, like, you know, like there's not even like an off year, you know, there's not an election in November. Justifies this. It's sort of just like, I really want my vacation. I really want, you know, I've already set the plans to go to the beach and whatever it is. And I mean, I understand, I'm going to take a week in August. I want to go on vacation. But if like, I don't know, there was some major, like the biggest thing to ever happen to this show.
Yeah,
in my career, I mean, you know, because passing a $4 trillion bill or voting against it That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And
I mean, this, you know, this is what, like, this is the greatest knock on Democratic leadership so far in the Biden administration is a lack of urgency. Just no sense that they need to move. Like, we got a false start with that, the first COVID relief bill, yeah, where it's like, finally, they're serious about moving fast, and it's a business as usual. And this is what happens when you just let people who've been in and around the Senate for 100 years control the pace of everything.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to sound, you know, sort of, I don't want to sound rude, but, you know, you've got those 50 Democratic senators there. They're there now.
They're there.
And every time Dianne Feinstein has to get on an airplane, just the
you should that be worried.
Amount of travel
yeah.
Is, you know, you've got people in their 80s, well into their 80s. Mm-hmm. Who are, you know, Democratic senators. And frankly, every step that they're forced to take outside of their, you know, sort of normal routine, frankly, is a potential opportunity for there not to be a majority when they get back.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I agree with you. Like, the urgency, that they really, it's going to take a lot of luck for this to go through. And so let me just also just, you know, address that I want to circle back. There's one point that, you know, there was a piece in the there was a reported piece in the New York Times yesterday that I found, or 2 days ago, that I found really disturbing. One half of it was that the pandemic aid has had really great impact on poverty in this country in a way that we have never seen a reduction of poverty so quickly in this country. Maybe not even seen this amount of reduction in poverty. Like, they're going to fall. The number of Americans living in poverty is going to fall by 20 million from the 2018 levels. That is almost a 50% decline. There were three programs attributed with cutting. It was the stimulus checks, the increase in food stamps, and expanded unemployment insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Poverty has fallen most amongst children, but it's dropped among like every sort of cohort you could imagine in America, race and age group and in every state. This is like a, you know, it should show you that we can do this.
Yeah.
It cost about $1 trillion.
Yeah.
It cost about $1 trillion. And embedded in that trillion, it's probably close to maybe $100 billion, $200 billion of fraud that took place in the unemployment insurance, specifically in the PUA part of it. Mm-hmm. That's the part that was expanded the universe of who could apply to unemployment insurance, like gig workers and private contractors, only because we didn't have a mechanism in which to sort of verify their thing. And we wanted to get the money out there quickly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something that, like, you know, time could easily fix. Here is the Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation, his response to hearing about these numbers. He says, there's no doubt by shoveling trillions of dollars to the poor, you can reduce poverty. First off, it wasn't trillions. It was 8 trillion. It's probably closer to 800 billion that actually reached people. But okay.
Yeah.
We've solved it.
Yeah.
Trillions would reduce.
So
poverty.
You're saying,
but
there's a butt coming.
Here.
There's a butt coming.
This guy's
big
from the
butt.
Heritage Foundation. That's not efficient.
Oh.
And it's not good for the poor because, first of all, what could be more efficient than here's
sending
money
directly?
Yeah, it didn't.
You're not poor anymore. That's pretty efficient.
Like, mailing everyone a check is the single most efficient way I can think of to
a little more efficient than trickle down
the
economics.
The only more efficient way would be to put it into half of those people's bank accounts directly.
Yes, directly, yeah.
But that's not efficient, and it's not good for the poor.
Mm.
Why? Mm. Because it produces. You ready for this? Social marginalization.
Oh, I thought it was going to be dependency.
Well,
but social marginalization. Oh, interesting.
Yes. Because, you know, when you're living in poverty, you have the opportunity to be so social.
Yeah.
And when you're lifted out of poverty, you get you, people are looking at you and they feel like, we don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah, you. Does he also, you seem like.
Does he also mean like you'll be victim of like welfare queen myths that like people like us have been perpetrating?
Right. We're going to attack you.
Right. The problem, right, right. The problem with really efficient welfare spending is that me and my allies are going to demonize you to everyone we know.
Right, yeah.
we will make you a social enemy if you accept that money.
And then he says, you want policies that encourage work and marriage, not undermine it. So in other words, making people not poor. And remember, this is the party and the ideology that says mask wearing mm-hmm. is a form of social control, mm-hmm. right? Like you're talking about masks and you're trying to control people and turn people into sheeple. However, we also hold the belief that the problem with helping people out of poverty is you're not encouraging them to work and get married.
Yes.
That's also a racist, you know, dog whistle there. They're like, oh, where are the fathers, et cetera.
Think about the control, the social control embedded in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. No, I mean,
give people the freedom of not having, you know, someone else have coercive tools up over them. That's bad. But don't take that mask. Don't put that mask on because they're trying to control you.
Well, we know what he means by efficiency, just to double back there. Like the most from their perspective, when somebody is forced by poverty to serve a capitalist for maybe less than they would have negotiated otherwise, that's efficient. That's what he means right. by efficiency.
And then there's some really sort of disturbing things in here, which is like, you know, why, you know, I look at this like using Trump as, you know, at least driving some voters to the polls. Okay. Cause you get, and granted, this is like, you know, any reporter could go out and do something like this, but then you get this like a paragraph talking about this woman, this 29-year-old woman who suffered job loss. She was like made more than whole through these programs. Instead, her income rose above its pre-pandemic level, though she had not worked for a year. She received about $25,000 in unemployment benefits, three times what she would have received before the pandemic. Because of all the extra on the unemployment, $12,000 in stimulus checks with increased food stamp benefits and other help, her income grew to $67,000, almost 30% more than when she had a job. Now, of course, you know, you could provide half of these without, you know, the excuse of a pandemic, let's say. But without that help, I literally don't know how I would have survived, she said. We would have been homeless. Still, Ms. Goodwin has 29 mixed feelings about the large payments with no stipulations. In my case, yes, it was very beneficial. But she said that other people she knew bought big TVs and her former boyfriend bought drugs. Mm. All this free money enabled him to be a worse addict than he already was. Why should taxpayers pay for that? There was a couple of other quotes that were sort of like that too, where they're like, you know, one guy, okay, John Asher of Indianapolis once served prison time for selling drugs, but is now sober, earning $500 a week as a maintenance man. With $3,200 in stimulus checks, Mr. Asher was able, 49, was able to leave a boarding house, rent an apartment, take custody of an autistic son who he feared would go to foster care. But he said he distrusted the crooked government mm-hmm. and urged poor people to help themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. If you want to change your life, you have to get up and do something, not sit home and get free money, he said.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's some ideology right there.
There needs to be, before, I'm not saying that we shouldn't deliver this because we should deliver these material benefits on day one. But day two has to work on, the ideological underpinnings, and it has to be sustained. Day one has to be sustained.
Yeah. You got to defend this, right? Because
without a doubt,
these Americans, they've been marinating in anti-welfare propaganda their entire lives. Like, there is not kind words said about welfare spending pretty much anywhere in the media ever. And that includes Democratic politicians defending sending money to people.
Yes.
Right. Like, step one, help people because it's the right thing to do. But, like, step two, make a case for it, you know?
And so, like, I do think it's smart politics to bring out people to vote against Trump.
Yeah.
But they should be out there every day touting these impacts of these bills. Every yeah. single day. They should be holding, I don't know, like little town halls about it. Come up and tell me how this helped you.
Yeah.
What would help you going forward? Like, they've got to use this. You know, even if it was a Trump, you know, bill that you know, the $600,
yeah,
you keep talking about it because Democrats are more likely.
Yeah. I mean, look,
to continue right. these things.
Yeah. There's no there's no electoral penalty in taking credit for anything that happens, like while you are in the government.
Absolutely. And that's what I find a little bit frustrating. That hasn't happened at this point. Now, they did it a little bit with the COVID relief bill. You know, they tried to, and but it has to be far more.
I got a letter from Joe Biden with my child benefit. You know, Joe Biden signed it. I was like, thanks, Uncle Joe.
And there you go.
That's an improvement. I saw Blinken talking about the cuts to childhood poverty, and those are all great things that Democrats should be talking about. But he framed it as like, look at this wonkish good government stuff. It's kind of like Obama wanted to do. And it's like, no, you did something good for poor people. Like, it wasn't like you figured out some sort of thing in an Excel spreadsheet. Like, you decided to give poor people money.
That's the absolute funniest thing about this is like, they cannot get past, like, we just, you know, We did the closest a country can get to like a natural experiment here. And like poverty was up here, shoveled a lot of money to people, poverty down here. All right. What's the lesson there? And like there's a lot of people in there in Washington, their brain is still going to be like even liberal people are still going to be like, all right, how do we figure out poverty reduction? Like what's the technocratic formula to reduce poverty?
Right.
It's like, you just nailed it. You just figured
it out. Send money to people.
It's too direct. It's too direct. Or it's not direct enough, the direct payments.
Alex Perrine, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap things up for the week. All right, folks, that's our show for this week. If you are watching on the Peacock app, reminder, this show plays every night on the Peacock app at 11 p.m. And our other show plays at 4 p.m. And then I think it gets repeated at other times. But that is a need-to-know type of situation. So we will see you next week on Peacock. And we will see the rest of you right now.
Now.
Because it is time for Matthew Film Guy. We'll bring in Matthew Film Guy. Well, I want to read this. I am. Are you bitching again about how little Democrats do to promote the overall benefit of the policies they are now being forced to get behind? What does that mean? They're now being forced to get behind. It's almost as if sometimes you are willing to admit that the Democrats don't want to be held to a good policy. And then the rest of the time you pretend like you don't know what the hell is going on. I'm not sure I follow that, frankly.
I'm glad you read it though.
Huh?
I'm glad you read it though.
Well, I know I saw it and the first part of it sounded interesting, but now I can't quite make it out. I don't know. Like
it's someone that wants to stay mad.
I guess so. But I know somebody who doesn't. Oh, you cut your beard.
Yeah, I think I had it cut last time, but I understand you're getting up there.
Yeah, I can pay attention. But wait a second. I'm thrown off because don't we need something, Matt?
Yeah, give me 1 second. Going to the other desk.
We need to rejigger the studio because
this is what gives me energy. I can't do this without hearing
my nose.
Now we can go.
There it is, why? Ladies and gentlemen. Matthew Film Guy.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Emma. How you doing?
I'm good. Is that like a Gilbert Gottfried voice at the end of the song?
When he goes, Film Guy.
Yeah, no, maybe.
That's not Gilbert.
Well, it's a Metallica parody, so if you hear the original, they kind of do that in the original Master of Puppets.
I'm not into Metallica. I don't know if
really?
That is caught that vibe for
that
me.
That is a shock. That is a shock.
My music taste is...
You're more of a Slayer. Anthrax?
Cannibal Corpse.
Right.
Cannibal
right.
Corpse. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. True. Different generation. I understand.
Yeah.
So, Matthew Film Guy, you are looking very post pandemic y today. Your beard is cut short. Maybe I didn't notice it last time. Your hair is cut. Did you get new glasses?
Nope. None of these things are true, but still, I appreciate this talking about my appearance. That's really what I come on here for, is to
stop objectifying Matthew.
Thank you, Emma. I'm glad somebody said it.
Yeah. Just, checking out.
That's a progressive show.
See that you're here, and I'm excited.
I want you to love me for my mind and my soul, Sam.
I mean, of course I do, but, that is eternal. Your appearance is, news.
Yeah. No, it's definitely worth taking up the whole beginning of the segment about. It really is. I agree.
All right, if that's the way you're going to be.
I'll tell you this, though. I do happen to know that the only reason I am here is because of my appearance, in that I somewhat reminded you of a younger version of your friend Charlie. So that really is the first domino to fall in this long series of connections.
That's true. I mean, it wasn't so much a physical, although there's a little bit of physical. There's a physical quality, but there was also sort of like there was some other quality too. You were much more introverted back when we first met.
Yes, you helped me come out of my shell, and I thank you for that, Sam.
I really have, haven't I?
Okay.
Don't repeat it.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's those. Okay.
I'm gonna go back in my shell now.
Come shower with Crowder. Matthew Film Guy. Two older Jewish men talking about old people stuff.
Film is not old people stuff. I'm sorry. I mean, the media may be going the way of the dodo eventually, but in this day and age, it is still extremely valuable.
Also, and what am I, chopped liver?
Yeah.
Right. And
especially
so
when
Matthew.
You use those Yiddish borscht belt phrases like, what am I, chopped liver? You're hanging with the old guys.
All right.
We don't, this idea that film is for old people is ridiculous. So tell us about your learning annex class with seniors that you teach every year.
Well, the good news is the one good thing about the pandemic is that the class started as a senior citizens film appreciation class at the Common Point Queens Community Center, the Jewish Community Center in Queens. But since the pandemic, it's been on Zoom. So it's opened up to a lot of fresh blood, both in the metaphorical and literal sense, of a lot of young people. It includes also the Cedar Sisters, both of them, thank you. Not just one, but two Cedar Sisters have been in my class. And plenty of people who have connected with the class through seeing me on the Majority Report. So it's been a really wonderful side effect, unfortunately, of the pandemic. But it's the one thing that's really kept me in good spirits.
I'll be right back, Matthew.
I want to hear about what you've been up to in, like, now that we are in post-pandemic era and you are also post-Black Bear period. It was really unfortunate, I think, for you. Black Bear came out. It was a film that you edited, but it came out during the pandemic when there was, like, no production and any of the fervor around that, sometimes the intensity of, stuff diminishes a little bit, but I would imagine there's got to be some directors out there going like, I got to get this guy who edited that. Have you been going and doing any job interviews? Have you heard from, Scorsese reached out? What's happening?
First of all, I want to hope that it is post-pandemic, because the pandemic has been a severe blow to millions of people's lives, but also to my feature film editing career, which, as you noted, was hit because most independent film got completely shut down for a year. Some of it's starting to come back. I'm actually nervous that some of it won't be coming back now if there's a second wave or fourth wave, whatever we're on here. But yeah, I've had a few. I did get an agent after Sundance played Black Bear and did pretty well there. So I got an agent, and I've had a couple interviews. I've had a few things sent to me that I didn't necessarily think I was right for. But actually, to be honest, there was one interview I had that I kind of really wanted. It was for actually a TV show being edited by a particular comedian. And it's like sort of like an anthology series. It was going to be perfect for me because it was sort of like the crux between independent film and comedy. And that's sort of what my career has taken me on. But unfortunately, I was asked if I knew and how well I was associated with all of your buddies. You, David Cross, Mark Maron, Andy Kindler. Because this particular person took somewhat of exception to the way they treated him in the past. And, of course, I denied all associations. And
Wait. You're being a little bit obtuse here. Like, I'm not following. So you met with a TV person, like an executive
comedian,
producer,
pretty well-known comedian, actor, writer, director now. And I thought we had a pretty good interview, but it turns out.
And what's this person's name?
Huh?
You're not saying the name.
I don't know. Should I say the name?
I don't know. How many bridges do you want to burn?
I mean, it seems like it's already pretty burnt, so I guess it's not a big deal. But I'll just maintain plausible deniability for the moment. But, you know.
So this person was a comedian, but they have acted in TV shows and now are writing and presumably, you know, writing and creating shows. And they look at your resume and they see what they see. Like, what do you have on your resume?
That I've done videos with you. Bad Situationist and the crew of that. I did stuff for Tinkle with.
That's not a video. It's not a video.
Feature film.
It's a feature film.
Direct video, but still feature film. Pilot season had a lot of these guys. All my stuff with Mark Maron over the years, can't really hide that. I did a lot of great work that I'm very proud of with Mark Maron. But that was like, it took up, I want to say the whole interview, but it was like a major portion of the interview. It was like, how close are you with those guys? Because I guess they teased this guy a little bit because he was a little bit younger and met with a lot of success early on.
And where did they tease him in comedy clubs or like?
Yeah, on stage. I think Andy Kindler may have included him in one of his State of the Industry speeches. So wow. I just want to say for every leg up I've gotten through you, this is now it's actually coming back to haunt me.
Well, not me. Fine. I've never critiqued that person.
No, but you know, it's through you that I got to know all these wonderful people that I've mentioned.
And so, you know, at that point, what you say is like, when someone does that, you say like, look, I worked for them, but I got to tell you, huge a-holes.
You think I didn't? I was dancing. I was like, Did you say that? I barely remember them, but no, that's just, I used to know them. I had to move on.
They're huge a-holes and boy, stories I could tell you, but of course I wouldn't do it right now, you know. That's what you got to do.
I got to admit, I was blindsided by that. Did not expect that. But thank you for that hard-won wisdom that you're handing me there. I definitely will do that next time. Throw you under the bus. Let me make that note. Hardcore.
I have no problem with that whatsoever. I would encourage that.
I appreciate that. You know, you understand this business as much as anybody. I saw who's the caboose.
Yeah. So, and that's it? You just had one failed interview that you're blaming on all the people who have done nothing but help you in your career?
Let's face it. You don't want to hear about every single trial and tribulation I've gone through. But, I've read a few scripts since the pandemic has started to slow. So things are starting to pick up. And, it's just around the corner as far as my agents are concerned. But listen, in the meantime, it's a good news, bad news situation. The pandemic has allowed me to go full film guy. Being underemployed has allowed me to delve into the side of cinema that I really enjoy, watching the really hardcore art films, the kind of films that I've been showing to my class. And I've had a lot more time to do that. So it's kind of a good thing. But, I still have got to pay the rent and get, this career on track because I really do want to be editing more feature films. So, it's good news, bad news. But listen, always look on the bright side of life. Right, Sam?
Absolutely. I think I'm very much an optimist in that way, Matthew. So, yeah, of course.
I come to you for that kind of pick-me-up.
It's the 20th anniversary of Wet Hot American Summer. Were you aware of that?
Ooh, no, actually, I did not know that.
Really?
How are you celebrating?
Well, you know, I thought maybe you might appreciate this because I should have pulled it. David Wayne, who is the director of it, right? I mean, he was the one of the guys from the state. He put out like a thing on TikTok that was, maybe you guys can find it. It was on TikTok, three part thing, talking about the 20th anniversary of Wet Hot American Summer, which is really a huge cult classic, isn't it, for people?
And I was never in that cult particularly, but I appreciate the movie.
Yeah, yeah. But he did a big, he did like a hat tip to Who's the Caboose? Because at that time, I think like...
You showed it was possible to have no idea what you're doing and still make a good movie.
Exactly. Exactly. That's basically true. It. I mean, I remember, you know, saying to him like, oh, dude, you should put it in. Why are you shooting on film? Don't be ridiculous. And
that was a little too galaxy brain for him at the time.
Well, yeah. And it worked out that it actually worked out for him. So
that also means, Sam, that it's the 20th anniversary of you and me. It's the 20th anniversary of Bad Situationist. We were shooting it maybe right at this time, right? 20 years ago? Am I getting my timelines right?
Oh, my God. That's right.
Can I get some fanfare?
Yeah. In fact, I think at this point we'd already finished shooting it and we started to edit. Well, but you weren't part of that round of editing. But
not
we
at the had time, just,
it is 20 years since we met, I guess. Wow.
Feels like just yesterday I was... rolling a giant joint at the rap party and yelled at me for using all the weed in one joint. What are you doing? That was one of my favorite moments.
I don't remember that.
Fucking serious? I'm like, Cheech and Chong did it. No. Anyway.
You just, a giant, giant joint?
Yeah, it was like the
no
whole...
No tobacco
like,
or...
Nope. I was like, here's the bag, Matthew. Make some for the party. I made one big one. And you like flipped out.
Are you fucking
stupid? What are you doing?
It is a little bit wasteful, but I appreciate the effort.
Totally wasteful.
Yeah. Yeah.
So wasteful.
No, in retrospect, I learned a serious lesson that day. Don't do that. But
right.
That's, you know, the follies of youth, Sam.
Well, I hope you learned that lesson. I hope that's, you know, that was the one thing that Matthew learned.
I've never rolled a Cheech and Chong joint ever again.
Yeah.
It's just for the movies, not
for
real.
The movies. So
I used
Matthew,
to use movies in reality, not now.
Let's talk about what we should watch. I should tell you right now that I've watched. I have not been watching any TV whatsoever.
Yeah,
no movies. I mean, of course, I watched Peter Rabbit 2 the other day.
Did it hold up against the sequel, against the original?
He wouldn't even watch Peter Rabbit 1. I'm like, dude, we got to watch Peter Rabbit 1 first. And he's like, no, you can watch them. They make sequels. You can see what's going on.
So like, his purism does not extend. Like, I thought his Marvel purism might extend to the other series.
No. But we did watch Black Widow, which I thought was one of the better one of those type of movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
good,
but
nice.
I watched a TV show with Milo for the first time in ages, and we both liked it.
Oh, do
White
tell.
Lotus.
Oh, is that good?
Yes, Mike White. You know Mike White.
Matthew? Oh yeah, from Chuck and Buck.
Yes,
nice.
Exactly. That's the thing is that you, people like you and I only remember Chuck and Buck. And
also,
that was 25 years
ago. The Good Girl with Jennifer Aniston. That was also a great one. But Chuck and Buck, his DV feature.
White Lotus. I mean, I've only seen like 3 or 4 episodes, but it's pretty good. And it's just a limited run, I think. So.
I love Jennifer Coolidge so much.
Yes, she's quite good.
I'll check that out.
But I thought you would have been aware of that. I guess not. So
no, I mean, I'm going super huge film guy here. I literally have a watch list on Letterboxd, and people can go find me on letterboxd.com at Langdon Boom and see what I'm watching and see what I want to watch. It's 1400 or 1500 films long. So I really get like a guilty conscience when I start watching a series these days. Although Mary and I are rewatching The Sopranos, which I haven't seen in whatever it is, 15 years. She never
saw
it.
Hold up.
Definitely. In fact, I appreciate it more this way through, because it's like I'm not confused like who's who and what's going on. The filmmaking in that is really, really excellent. They invented the sort of prestige drama. So I appreciate it actually more this way through, because I'm not so wrapped up in the who's whacking who kind of.
Yeah, I'm into, I've been thinking about revisiting that too lately.
That's actually something else I remember from Bad Situationist. I think I was at your place one time and you're like, okay, it's time to go, because we got to watch Sopranos. Like, the meeting is over. It was like destination TV. And that's the first time I heard of it. I'm like, what's that?
Well, also, there was not a huge opportunity to, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have
a DVR. Sources.
It wasn't, it was all VHS, right?
Yep, for sure.
God.
And it was destination viewing.
We are old. Like, you had to like wait.
Nice until, to
like,
get old.
Three
nice
in the to morning old. To watch it over. You know, if you missed it at the first time at 10 p.m. Yeah. or whatever it was.
Right. 1 a.m. Actually, I did start to watch a series, which I was actually impressed by. But it's sort of a pretentious series, because it was made by Canal Plus with Fox, called War of the Worlds, kind of a reimagining of the original H.G. Wells idea. But it's pretty great. Multinational cast. Some of it's in French, so you'll like that, Sam. I think it was on a network called Epix. It was free for a while online, so I caught it there, but you might need that. But if you're looking for a series, you could do worse than that.
I'm gonna go back to The Sopranos after I finish. I'm watching for the first time Boardwalk Empire.
That's pretty good. It's heavily in the shadow of The Sopranos, but I enjoyed that and I watched it completely.
I like the historical, I love learning about the history of these gangs in Chicago and New York and Atlantic City, and how Pacino, Capone rose to prominence, and Arnold Rothstein, cool characters.
Yep, definitely. So, and they're pretty, they're like 80%. Basically, everybody except Nucky is pretty historically accurate in that
Right.
All right, so Matthew, film guy.
Yes, here I am.
What do you have for us this week?
All right, at the risk of alienating the youthful audience that you attract, I do want to recommend.
You know what? You say that in jest, but the fact of the matter is that
not just.
To the extent that we have data, and we have some decent data, the majority of our audience is younger than I think both of us.
That's good. I hope they all become members.
Like Emma is right buy in the every... center of our, well.
Really?
Well, maybe you're a little bit on that. I mean, it's like.
On the younger side.
Like the average age probably comes out to about 30.
That's good. I hope every single one of them buys a Hello Tushy bidet and Sunset Lake Say Bidet. And, I hope they really keep you going for many, many, many years.
Well, please,
there you
it's
go. There's a guy. Sibidae. That's Sibidae. Sibidae.
Why don't you just say
eBay store resent?
No. Don't even say the first part of that.
You can't say it. What is that? Why? They want money from that?
It's just.
Yeah, all right. Didn't mean to bring up a sore topic.
That's okay. So, all right. Let's get the brass tacks here.
Brass tacks. What am I going to watch? Okay. So I've fallen in love with Korean cinema lately. I think I may have mentioned a filmmaker named Hong Sang-soo on the show before, but I've just been watching basically Hong Sang-soo's movies. So I started to branch out, and last week I watched pretty much all the entire oeuvre of another guy named Lee Chang-dong. And he is not on the same level as Hong Sang-soo, but he actually got better with every film up until this film that I saw, and it's called Poetry. And it is on Amazon streaming. Sam will almost never watch it. But if you want a serious look at a filmmaker at the height of his powers, making a film about, the ways in which art itself can actually be healing and actually be, constructive to the individual person. It's about an older woman who is... I can't even really give you the main plot element to it, because it's kind of subtle and interesting when you find out. The filmmaking it's not afraid to be mundane, but it's not like super durational cinema where you're just like watching paint dry. The performances are very naturalistic and restrained. And even this horrific event that's at the center of it is sort of downplayed off screen. But it's basically about an older woman who at a certain point in her life, something happens. She gets diagnosed with Alzheimer's and she joins a poetry writing class. And she's at the heart of this scandal connected with her young son, who's actually her grandson that she's raising. And, you know, it's just about, it's literally walking you through, giving you the experience, not telling you the point, but giving you the experience of the way art, and in this case, poetry, but also this actual filmmaker's art, the cinema, can be healing, can be, you know, ennobling to the human endeavor, can actually be a positive force and not just, you know, a filigree, a little decoration, little escape. I was blown away. My class, I showed it to my class. It was one of the high points of our 6-week course. And I think anybody who's into the cinema or just likes movies in general will be drawn into this. It has the edge of almost like an exploitational kind of thing, but it really avoids that trap. And it's just, I just can't recommend it any more highly. What happened? Did you lose me?
Oh, wow.
Oh, no, we lost Sam.
We lost Sam to a power outage.
Oh, my God.
Good. Now let's talk about what I really...
Yes. My takeover is complete.
The majority report is on.
Yes, it is. Now, Matthew, film guy.
Okay, let's ditch.
Let's bitch. Yeah, he'll never watch Korean cinema, please.
No, he won't. Hopefully, I'll get through to a few of the young whippersnappers out there looking for something different.
You sold me a bit. What's your next recommendation?
I also watched a movie that's probably a little bit more palatable to the politically minded audience we have, and that is Breaker Morant. Have you ever heard of this movie? Matt, maybe you've heard of it, or Bradley?
I haven't, no.
It's an Australian film. It's basically about an incident that occurred in the war between the Boers and English. They were fighting in South Africa. It was sort of the Dutch versus the English in South Africa in 1900. And they were sort of the first people to do this guerrilla war. And it's about the way the English soldiers were trying to adapt to the way the Boers were fighting a guerrilla war. It's very clearly a Vietnam analog about like the rules of war changing and how empire has to sort of have it both ways, both be seen as being benevolent, but also being willing to break the rules of war. And it's sort of like a procedural courtroom drama. It's sort of like you see what they did and they're on trial for it. And that one's much more accessible. It's not an unserious film, but it's, you know, the filmmaking is sort of more like classical art cinema, sort of filmmaking.
Can you repeat the title?
Breaker Morant.
Breaker Morant.
Starring Edward Woodward. Old fart in the bath, as they used to call him, Edward Woodward.
Edward Morant.
Breaker Morant. Breaker Morant. By Bruce Beresford.
All right. Breaker Morant. Gotcha.
1980.
Wow.
Matthew, I do love that La Ventura poster behind you.
Oh, you like all that? That's actually my partner Mary's. Mary loves Antonioni.
We
had to agree on what the posters were, so Bresson and Antonioni.
And Hazard Baltazar, very cool. Very cool.
Bresson, you know, he's the godhead. He's, you know, if anybody's into cinema and you haven't seen Bresson, go eat him up.
So, Matt, I have a recommendation for folks, but this is actually one I don't know if people we should be recommending people go to the theaters now, but I did go to one movie since the sort of reopening.
Is it Zola?
Zola.
Yeah, me too. That's my only movie I've seen since the reopening.
And I don't know if it's just because it's been so long that I've been in the theater, but I loved it. I thought it was amazing. I thought the editing, I thought it was very funny. I can't get over. I think people should definitely see Zola. I don't know if they should see it in theaters.
Is it sort of a rom-com?
It's like an adventure tale sort of thing. Yeah, it's not a rom-com really by any sense. It reminds me of another Miami movie. Maybe it's just because of the Florida setting, but Spring Breakers. Down to earth than that. But there's still a lot of very like interesting style parts of it about like the way the editing's done. A lot of very humorous parts. I thought it was so good.
I think the Florida Project meets Spring Breakers, right? Because it has a little bit of that grunge element to it as well. Yeah, I liked it a lot. I wanted it to be longer and didn't. I thought the ending like was a bit anticlimactic, but I really liked it a lot too.
Interesting. I'll definitely put that on.
I thought it was really funny. Like that was, I wasn't expecting that. It's based on a Twitter thread.
That's what really? I was gonna say. It's adapted from a 100 tweet Twitter thread.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's about a waitress that strikes up a relationship with a dancer, and then they go supposedly to dance, but they get into all sorts of hijinks. I think it's amazing how it is based on that Twitter thread, and they made one of the most. Maybe I'm gushing about it too much, but I thought it was so entertaining, and also like not like a lot of other movies you see. The editing, like I said, Matt, I think you'd really appreciate it because there's a lot of funny, interesting stuff going on there.
Sweet, I love it. That's definitely going to go on the list. Where did you see it? Did you see it in like a normal movie theater? You don't have to dox yourself.
Well, I don't mind because I've never been to this theater before, but there's one in Brooklyn here on Court Street that's like an old theater.
Right.
And I saw it there because everywhere else was sold out. BAM was sold out, all the other places in Brooklyn. And that was the only place that was available. And it was, even in the small like theater, it wasn't like an IMAX or anything like that. It was still just great to see.
I went to the Alamo Draft House. Do you have an Alamo Draft House out by you, Matthew?
No, I don't. I've been to the iPick a few times.
That's like overpriced, though, I feel like. Like, I mean, Alamo does the same stuff, but it's not as fancy schmancy.
Do you have an Alamo take, Matthew, or about that type of movie experience?
Listen, I go to the iPick for the sort of big budget, you know, action movie, widescreen epics. Like, I wouldn't go there and want to be interrupted by a waitress or whatever while I'm trying to actually like fall into the soul zone of like a really serious film.
Right.
But I love going to those for like the Star Warses and the Marvels and so on. And I don't mind paying $25 if it means I'm in like that pod where there's just me and Mary and like I can't even see anybody on their phone. I can't hear anybody. It's like the best of both worlds, like being at home, but also being in the theater.
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't the Draft House guy canceled, though? Devin Faraci, Pharisee? I could be wrong. I don't mean to slander the man, but I thought the proprietor was like a pervert, but I don't mean to. So no lawsuits, I allegedly.
Bradley getting sued in his first week. That's amazing.
I mean, we could only hope.
You know, I never actually been to an Alamo Draft House. I know there's a couple around here, but I always appreciated their like super strict policy of don't use your phone, don't talk. I love how they had that in front of every movie. I mean, it's really, you know, you got to be, this is like, you know, it's the communism of the film going experience. Like, don't talk, don't use your
phone. Are you pumped about Dune?
I definitely am excited to see it. I mean, pumped. I was never like a huge fan of the book. I tried to read it in high school and sort of bailed on it. But, right. And the David Lynch movie is sort of like, okay, it's very Lynchian. But I am super excited to go see it. That's one I might actually go see in like the iPick or something.
I mean, you got to see Denis Villeneuve. I'm probably butchering
it. Yeah, you say it. I don't know.
Denis Villeneuve.
All his films I've enjoyed.
Arrival was one of my favorite experiences to see on a big screen. I mean, and I didn't love Blade Runner 2049. But I loved watching Blade Runner 20, like the right. visuals of Blade
Runner. Just on an aesthetic Runner. Level, just on a photography level. Yeah, I agree. I didn't love it either, but I would watch it. I didn't regret watching it.
Matthew, right. Do you have any opinions about the return of theaters, or if they're gone, or if we should be lamenting this moment? Or
listen, I have been somewhat of a curmudgeon on the whole theater experience. Like, I actually think tickets should always be $15 or $20, like you're going to a play or like you're going to, you know, to people to take it more seriously. So I don't personally miss going to theaters that have people talking in on their phones. I'm not that sad about it. I definitely think they'll come back. People like doing it. I don't, just on a pure business level, I don't think it's ever going to go completely away. Of course, given that if the virus doesn't mutate into something more virulent, that, I mean, God forbid. But, you know, I think, you know, you just said Black Widow, that still did plenty of bank. I mean, not compared to the other ones. So I don't see that as being a big thing. But I prefer personally watching movies where I can control the total environment because, you know, I think of them as like going to church. I mean, obviously when it's not action films and so on and that's super loud explosions, that's
right.
Do what you will. But to try to get into a subtle and meditative state and then someone's just like, nah, man, I'm just at the theater. You know, like what? You know, that's... I
get that. I just need, for a movie like Dune, for example, which I'm looking forward to, I can't watch that on my stupid little TV in my apartment. I need the full experience.
And it's so much easier to fall into it when it's taking up your full peripheral vision, and its sound and vision is all encompassing. I mean, yeah, there's nothing like it. It's the way the medium was intended. I agree with David Lynch, who said, if you think you saw a movie on your phone, you didn't. I mean, it's a big difference, especially a movie that's taking advantage of medium in that way. So,
And even like COVID aside, I'd say like, I'm pretty bullish about like theaters in the sense that I feel like there are so many vestigial art forms, like, you know, like vinyl, bookstores, like books itself, baseball, for example, where everyone, I mean, I feel like we've been saying that these things are going to be dead for like literally 60 years now. So I'm still like not, I'm not certain, or I really have no like real prediction that there's going to be like a year where like everyone, like, all movie theaters shutter, like no one's done. I just always think there is like a contingency of people who like earnestly want to see it in that way. And like me included, like I really just like, I don't think, I'm more bullish on it not happening much sooner than a lot of people I think have predicted recently.
I think you're right. People like to go out. They like to go to dinner. Then they go to a movie. They like to go with groups. They like to go on dates. You know, there's this social aspect to it that I think will survive. I mean, I do also in my film guy sort of orthodoxy lament the what is changing is our attention spans. So even though a Marvel movie is 2 hours and 45 minutes, it's not letting you rest for any, you know, more than 10 seconds. So there is a kind of imaginative sort of loosening that I think is happening. And that's why I try to push these harder to sort of see movies and talk about it in my class, because that is something that I see even in myself, even in my own ability to pay attention to something is retarded by, like, I feel the pull to go to my phone after 15 minutes, or I feel the pull to, you know, do anything else. Usually I just adjust the Adderall dose, but still there's, you know, there's, that is an issue that I think is a trend, let's say. And I don't know what's
solved a bit by movie theaters, though, right? Because I think that's why I like it too. If I'm in my normal place of existence, it's so easy for me to like check Twitter or check text.
But that's the thing. Still, people are, it's a sea of blue faces in the last few theaters I've been to, you know? So it's like, it's unfortunately fighting a losing battle in some ways.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's why, you know, listen, we talk a lot about politics on your show. You know, you hear about politics and things that people have to do collectively, but it's still an internal singular battle to, keep your attention on things and to have that moment of silence and silence the voices and the sounds and the thoughts. And it's a challenge. And movies like poetry, I think, actually help you learn to engage that way. And, you know, it's why it sometimes falls on deaf ears, but still.
I can't watch anything by myself that's longer than a half hour anymore. Like, any movie or TV watching longer than that is with my girlfriend. And I do miss the experience of going to movies alone, just like after work or something like that, because that is, like you said, it is like it's a different kind of experience. I don't like how much of a cop Alamo Drafthouse turns everyone into, but it helps you experience.
I don't mind.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't mind.
Well, I mean, I'll never forget one of my best movie experiences ever was I smoked a joint and I went and I saw what's the movie with Leo DiCaprio with the bear?
The Revenant.
I saw The Revenant alone. You gotta mute yourself, Bradley. I saw The Revenant alone, stoned, and like freaky. But those visuals were crazy.
Right.
No,
I didn't see that one, but I understand he engages with the bear.
It was so beautiful, and anyway, movie going experiences alone. I also think I saw Wolf of Wall Street alone. Anyway, that's a different story. But
I had to stop getting stoned to see movies because I started, I lose the thread. I'm just like colors and sounds. And I started going like, what are we? Why do we like this? Like, so it was hard to follow.
I saw Inherent Vice very, very stoned once. And I think it might have actually added to the experience. But I agree, typically, it's hard to follow.
I was sober watching Inherent Vice and I didn't follow it. So I can't even imagine.
I liked Inherent Vice. It's like just a funny sort of riff on the detective genre. Well, I didn't love it, but it was silly.
I'm sort of like, I'll love anything sort of downstream of Pynchon, regardless of if it's trash or not, basically.
Have you heard of the movie Pig that's coming out with
Nicolas Cage? I got my eye on that one for sure.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
What do you think about Cage?
know, he could have been one of the greatest actors of the generation. When he started out, he really had that just like, you know, method, crazy, willing to do anything, really soul searing. And then he just like took every film that came his way and just became a parody of himself. I mean, it sort of happened to everybody that was in that way, De Niro, Pacino. They eventually just sort of cashed all their checks. And you know, he made a few here and there. Like I loved his remake of, or not remake, but sort of Bad Lieutenant, Portacall, the one with Werner Herzog. So he's come back onto the side of the light a few times, but for the most part. And then I saw that movie Mandy, where he's sort of like, just like, why not? I'll just be a parody of myself. And I enjoyed it, but it's hard to take him seriously. But he could have been like a serious actor. He could have been like Daniel Day-Lewis, the way we think of him today. But he just, I don't know, he made a choice.
What I'd say about Cage, though, that really recommends him is that he's a legitimate weirdo. Like, he's not like a performative weirdo. Like, he's actually like genuinely bizarre as a person. And like, I mean, he just had an interview where he said he constructed a geodesic dome for his pet crow, and that he lost millions of dollars like buying prehistoric fossils and things like that. Like,
well, he's got him to lose,
right. He's just like, he's truly like a real eccentric, and I think one of the few like Dadaist performers today, because like he'll just make like truly movies that are so unartistic that they're like artful. Like Knowing, that's my recommendation for today, is like his apocalypse movie, and it's like, it's the most inscrutable bizarre thing I've ever seen, but I think it's worth a watch.
I love inscrutable. I hate to scroot, but that's I'll watch that, Knowing with Nicolas Cage. Thank you.
I heard he's a real weirdo from just Seth Rogen's book that just came out. There's some,
I think he just like married a 15-year-old or something like that. I don't want to get sued either, but
oh, nice. I mean, I say that sarcastically.
A lot of slander today.
Nicolas Cage, call my people. You know, it's, I just wish that guys like that with talent just wanted to do more. You know, take risks. And I guess he has sort of done that towards the end. I'm just thinking of that Mandy, and maybe this pig is one of those things.
You know, De Niro did some real shitty stuff, but he's still, I think, more consistently tried to challenge himself as he gets older.
Really?
Like, I'll say something a little more controversial. Meryl Streep doesn't really challenge herself as much. Like, she works with directors that just let her be herself. Or, like, let her act her ass off. And it's not like, oh, I'm going to work with Tarantino on this movie, or this, like, very creative filmmaker, which challenges me to be kind of less of just actor.
I find that these people start to develop a bag of tricks that they can go to over and over. In their early days, they were more sincere. They were more connected to the source. And they then just sort of fall back on, you know, craft, which is, you know, no joke to have that craft. But they're not exposing themselves in that really, you know, deep way anymore, and they're just they're workers, they're, you know, yeah. And God forbid they make a living, but that's fine. Although I recently actually watched, speaking of Meryl Streep, I actually watched Sophie's Choice. I had never seen that, and I saw that during the pandemic. That's a terrible movie. That is an awful movie. And
it's,
I don't know if you're
just like designed to just pull at your heartstrings in the most maudlin way.
And it's like, I didn't realize, people don't know this, I guess, from its reputation, but it's like a coming of age. It's like the sexual coming of age of some young guy told through the story of this horrible Holocaust widow. It's like offensive, actually. And she does, you know, sort of sticky accent stuff. But yeah, that's like her golden seal. And I didn't buy it.
I mean, she's great. I just mean, like, now she just chews the scenery, I think, a little more. Right. And like, then you buy into that. But it's not... She's not working with somebody who's, you know, pushing the boundaries.
Yeah, if you want to get depressed about this sort of thing, look at Bruce Willis's, like, five most recent movies, man.
Yeah.
Like, 10 Minutes Gone, Trauma Center, Survive the Night, Hard Kill, Breach, Cosmic Sin, Midnight in the Switchgrass, Out of Death, A Day to Die. Like, I haven't heard a single one of these. I mean, I guess I miss a lot of movie trailers because I don't watch a lot of TV. Man.
I never thought of him as a great actor. He was always a personality, right? He's one of these guys that's just like charismatic. He does his smirk and you just love him because of like his shtick. But he didn't have that depth. I don't think that a Cage eventually or at one time did.
A lot of these guys do direct to DVD stuff also now. Like, some of that stuff is also why we probably haven't heard it, because it's literally just like cashing a check for something that like people won't even be watching on airplane.
Do people still buy DVDs?
That's another good question. That's probably why we haven't heard of it either.
Yeah, I don't even bought a DVD in I don't know how long. I bought a couple Blu-rays actually.
But, Matthew Film Guy. I mean, we don't know where Sam is. We're so sorry. He had a power outage.
I found I forgot all about him. So this is perfectly fine.
Yeah, I don't know. Should we let you go? What's protocol here?
I can hang out. But also, I just wanted to mention one other film that actually came to mind while Matt was talking. Matt, sure. Did you ever see the old Frank Capra movie, Lost Horizon?
No, I haven't.
That's a recommendation. I don't know why I thought of you for that one. But it's about a British diplomat whose plane gets diverted after a war in China. It was made in between World War I and World War II. And it's it's where the term Shangri-La came from. Their plane crashes and they find this like hidden area in a valley where like all men are brothers and peace reigns. And he's this like diplomat who the world is looking for and on the brink of war. It's actually really amazing.
Wow, that's bizarre. That's a great plot.
Yeah, it's based on a novel. And Frank Capra made it. And I highly recommend it too. Let's take some calls. Who's next?
Well, we have to do the call system. We thought Sam was doing that, so...
I don't know if we can even do calls.
Okay. We might need to take a quick break really quickly.
Yeah, we'll go to the fun half. But Matthew Film Guy, thank
Matthew.
You so much.
My pleasure, guys. This was a lot of fun. It was a little extra treat just to talk to all you guys. So
yes, well, we got the big elephant in the room out of the way. So behind the scenes when I went to the restroom.
My power went out. I don't know. How does this work? Oh, my God. Hey. Blessing
you, Michael. Yes, that was a good callback there. Thank all right, you. Matthew. Thanks so much. Everybody, we're going to head into the fun half. Check out Left Reckoning, right, Matt? And the number is 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy. Total, pussy, 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 total, pussy.